As one of the world's most prolific Shakespearean directors and actors, Tina Packer has very personally entered the psyche of Shakespeare and his female characters, and she has quite beautifully embraced in five plays entitled Women of Will, the personal and archetypal life of a woman, something Shakespeare portrayed throughout his writing and acting career. Tina is the founder and artistic director of Shakespeare & Company in Lenox, Massachusetts, and presently is acting and directing for the Colorado Shakespeare Festival in Boulder, Colorado. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Tina, welcome to Boulder.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you here, and I saw the performance the other night, and it's just fantastic. It made me wonder why I ended up going to Stratford-on-Avon once upon a time when such great Shakespeare was going to be coming to Boulder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Was this your first visit?
No, I've been here a couple of times before just for conferences, so it's my first time I've ever stayed in Boulder, and it's an extraordinary place.
Oh,
really is.
What drew you into William Shakespeare's work initially? Were you an actress first, or were you
a student of
Shakespeare's?
No. I was never a student of Shakespeare, so I always came into it through the theatre. It is true, in school, we did a lot of Shakespeare plays, and I have to say we had a very good English teacher because she made us get up and say it and act it out rather than sitting behind our desk, which I think is essential teaching Shakespeare. You know, when you teach Shakespeare to kids, get them act out, you know.
Well, any acting, I would imagine.
Well, or any acting, yes, any acting. So I did, I had that kind of love, and I like you, went to Stratford-upon-Avon, and I loved it. But it really was when I was at the Royal Academy, and of course, by this time, we're doing a whole range of plays, and what I found was every time I did Shakespeare, I learnt more. I understood more about myself, so I wasn't kind of just impersonating people. It actually was expanding my mind and who I was as a human being. And very shortly after that, I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company. I had a kind of very swift trajectory. And so, my mind expanded enormously. And I was with some extraordinary people there, but John Barton was my teacher, and he's great on Shakespeare's text. And so, again, it blew my mind that I learned all kinds of things. So it really was because every time I did any Shakespeare, I grew as a human being. That's really why I got hooked into it. And then when I'd go back to a modern play or, you know, my mind wouldn't expand in the same way. I wouldn't have to struggle to understand. I wouldn't get such philosophic insight. And, of course, the poetry is sublime and it puts you in a different place. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It alters your consciousness.
Yes, exactly. That rhythm.
Yeah.
The rhythm really does have its way of working in the mind.
Well, it does. And the rhythm reflects the emotion and feeling. And if you get the emotion and feeling right, then you start having the rhythm right. And, of course, you're breathing all the time as well. So it gives you the actual visceral feeling inside yourself as you're doing the Shakespeare text. I mean, it's extraordinary, you know.
And it's turned you into a psychic because you've just pretty much answered my next question, which basically is, what is it that has kept Shakespeare's work alive through all of these ages?
I think it's that. I think, you know, the other thing that he does, and you see it especially in a play like Antony and Cleopatra, here are two human beings who are icons, you know, but they're struggling inside themselves to find out who it is that they are and how is it that they relate to each other. And yet everything they do affects everybody in the world, and they represent a whole culture in the world, you know, and she's the incarnation of Isis and he's Dionysus, you know, but Shakespeare's writing on all these levels, on the kind of social political level, but then on this interior level at the same time, and so you get all these strands of the story going on at the same time, and the audience might not realize it because a lot of it happens in the unconscious mind. mind, you know. But my God, you find yourself thinking about it afterwards and kind of thinking, well, why did that happen? Why did that? It's just fascinating.
Yeah, it keeps drawing you in.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, you know, underneath all the plays are these three huge questions. What does it mean to be a human being? Or what does it mean to be alive? You know, and then there's the next question, which is how much we act. What's the collective action that should be taken here? And then there's the individual thing. What must I do? You know, and those questions are behind all the plays, even the early plays. And not so much, but if you put it up against Hamlet, you know, it's an ending. but because of that, you always feel that you're in the midst, even if it's one of his farces, you're in the midst of some kind of clownish philosophy that actually has great secrets about the life, you know.
Well, we all get drawn in there.
Yeah.
And it, as straight and philosophic as it is, it's completely comical at the same time.
It is.
Just to see where we get stuck.
I know. And I mean, that's true of Antony and Cleopatra. They get stuck all the time. And they do terrible things to each other. And they pay each other out. But they keep on coming back. I mean, that's really it in the end. It's the courage to love. It's the courage to love deeply. And they do that in the end, you know, right into death, as indeed do Romeo and Juliet, their counterparts, you know, their teenage counterparts.
Right. Do you think that William Shakespeare was, I mean, obviously he grokked all of these things and was able to portray it not only in play, but also with that rhythm, pentameter, and that just really does connect all of us.
Yeah.
But why do you think he was so aware in that time?
I think there were a couple of reasons. It was an extraordinary time anyway. But I think as far as he was concerned, he's an actor. So he's saying the words all the time. He's not writing the words, he's saying them. Even when he's writing them down, he's still enacting them. But I do think the times themselves were very key because we're just coming out of the medieval world, you know, where everything has a very kind of place and a form. I'm being a little cliched here, but a little general, but it has a place and a form. And then suddenly there's this whole kind of burst of learning as all the old Greek and Roman manuscripts come into play because the printing press has come into play 100 years before. So by now it's passed down to the people and there are lots of copies of things. And there's this whole thing of we now know the world is round, not flat. Is God really in heaven or is there something else up in the heavens? Is that the music of the spheres up there? What is this? So there's this whole burst of new ways of looking at things that had been stagnant for hundreds of years. Yes. And then there's the language itself, which is a mixture of Anglo-Saxon and Latin. And by merging those two languages, you get the English language, which now has such a potential to say so many things. So Shakespeare invented something like 1,700 words, or he's the first person we can fine. And so they're naming new psychological states, new emotional states, new ways of looking at things. They're naming them at this time. So I think it's all that stuff. And besides, Elizabeth was a very, very good ruler. You know, she was a very good leader. And it was the first time they'd had a woman leader for so long. And I do think it made a difference.
Yes.
Though I say it myself.
What was the moment in your career, Tina, that gave birth to this five-play project, Women of Will, which we are seeing up at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival here in Boulder?
Well, you know, I was an actor first, then I was a director, and I'm a teacher as well. So I was about two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the way through the canon, having directed most of the plays, and I was doing a production of The Tempest. And we lived in Edith Wharton's house, The Mount, in those days, for the first 23 years of Shakespeare and Company. That's where we lived. And I had got Ariel up on the top of the house, creating this huge storm. And and the house was the boat, was the ship cracking apart, and a huge soundscape, you know. And then the actor playing it was magnificent, an actor called Midori Nakamura. She was naked except for just a little loincloth, and she could make her body into either a man's body or a woman's body. She was an extraordinary actor. Anyway, at the end of... So I was very deeply attached to her performance. I mean, I would always watch her performance. And at the end of the play, after she's persuaded Prospero to forgive all his enemies, you know, and she's his creative spirit, really, and he's letting her free, he's letting her go. And it felt like my creative spirit was being allowed to go as well. And then she passes Miranda, Prospero's daughter, on stage. Now, they never talk to each other in the play. She crossed her. And then Miranda is going back to the kingdom of ruling two kingdoms. And she's going back to civilization, which she's never known. And Miranda turned around and looked at Ariel. And Ariel by this time was back in the woods and turned around and looked at Miranda. And these two women looking at each other were so powerful. They'd never talked to each other in the play. And yet you had this sense that they'd always known each other. They were the feminine spirit. And one was going to freedom and the other was going to responsibility. And it just, it really moved me, and I started realizing that Shakespeare said something through women that he didn't say through men, or there were things that came through in the performance which weren't all necessarily written down, but that were there inherent in the plays themselves. And I got that, you know, Shakespeare doesn't really exist unless other people join with him in the creative act. You know, he doesn't exist. And I just realized that, you know, me as a woman, having now done nearly all the canon, and not many women have done that, you know, and that I had a perspective probably that others didn't have. And although there's a lot of good women doing Shakespeare now, they're catching up fast. But, you know, this was about 15, 16 years ago. And so I thought, well, does Shakespeare change in his relationship to women? And I started realizing, my God, he does. He changes profoundly. This is a late play. And I know, you know, because I've done Taming of the Shrew a few times, and I have always had a problem with that play. He so bullies Kate Petruchio. So I started looking at it, and I got a Guggenheim to actually spend some time doing that. And so then I really went into the kind of research of it, and it just kind of fell out. After that, I did it in three parts, and then I realized there were actually five shifts in his writing about women. So that's when it became five parts. And I had to let it go for a long time, because being an artistic director means you're working 24/7, you know, all the time. And so I let it go for a few years. And then I was doing a production with Nigel Gore, and our chemistry really worked, as you probably saw.
Yes.
And there's something about that. So I'd been asked to do something for the Berkshire Women's Theatre, celebrating Berkshire Women artists. And so I asked him if he'd do a bit of this with me, and that's how it started again. Mm-hmm. And then he brought Eric Tucker, our director, on.
I see. Have you turned Shakespeare's characters into mythology of sorts, or do you think the mythology was already in place regarding the stages of awakening in a woman's life?
I think both things are true. I think Shakespeare, being an artist, intuitively understood those kind of things and the way in which you know, we live on both on a kind of archetypal level and a personal level. And I think what happened to him as he got to know women more and more, and different kinds of women, not just, you know, the girls from Stratford, but, you know, on all levels of society and in a city as well as in the court and things, as he got to know women better and saw who they were and the whole range of what they could do. And I think also, you know, inside himself, again, because he was writing about women, and I say this in part one, Margaret, which you can see in Richard III, you know, that's her fourth play. She's the only actor, that person that he gives four plays to. And I think as he wrote her, he began to understand women more and more. You know, so was he ever a boy actor who played women parts himself? He could have been, you know. But in any case, I think as he wrote them, he was in his interior self. After a bit, when he's writing the early plays, he's writing about women. But then as he starts switching over and starts inhabiting women, embodying women, then he starts to really understand them, you know.
Yes. What is known about his personal life during these times? I know this is another very lengthy topic, but we'll keep it short.
Well, you know, he got married at 18 to a woman who was 26, and they had three children very fast. So he was a father of three by the time he was 21. And obviously still living in Stratford. We don't know exactly how he got to London, but he did, I think, probably in 87. So when the twins, his youngest, were about three, I think he probably left home. And thereafter, he only seemed to go back once every two or three weeks a year. But he sends all his money home. So he builds a kind of base there. It is a kind of immigrant story, I suppose. But I think when you look at it, you know, his security was in Stratford, but it's not until the late plays when he starts writing about daughters and grown daughters at that, 15, 16 years old, the same age as his youngest daughter was by that time. You start seeing that, yes, he does have a relationship to daughters, but it's been missing for 15 years. Then, because all the late plays have 15, 16-year-old daughters in them. But what happens, I think, to his personal life is that, you know, the Elizabethans were much... They didn't have the rigidity about sex that we do, but on the other hand, they did have, you know, you didn't get divorced. I mean, occasionally marriages were null, but you didn't get divorced. So it was also about economics, about building the family wealth so everybody could live off the income. But I think what happened to Shakespeare is that he fell passionately in love, and I think it coincided with his whole awakening. Maybe it even was the thing that catapulted him into the awakening, or maybe he just was ready at that time. And he fell passionately in love with somebody, I believe, who's the dark lady in the sonnets. You know, he writes about it in some depth, but I think she's also the Rosaline in Love's Labour's Lost. She's probably the Rosaline in Romeo and Juliet, because she's the one he's passionately in love with at the beginning of the play, but you know but then Rosalind in As You Like It, but also Cleopatra and Cressida. I think they're all incarnations of her, and she's a woman with a very fast mind and a really, really good brain, as well as, you know, having black eyes and black hair and a dun skin. And it feels to me as if she is this woman called Emilia Bassano, whose family were Christianized Jews who originated in North Africa and then went up to Bassano and then came down to Venice, and they were musicians in St. Mark's, Christianized Jews by this time, and then went over to make Henry VIII's court. And she's the daughter of the youngest of those sons. And she's a harpsichordist in the court of Elizabeth. She's a poet in her own right. And
right. So he definitely acknowledged women in their beauty, in their gifts, in their intellect.
Absolutely. And in them not being the conventional beauty, and in them having a sexual life, not being sweet virgins on the pedestal, which is what he writes about in the early plays. But as soon as he stops that, he never, ever underestimates. He knows women's sexuality is part of who they are,
right.
You know, just as men's is.
Yeah, which a lot of people don't recognize today.
They don't recognize today. Well, you know, it's like making, you know, Jesus's mother a virgin. I mean, what did that do to women, for God's sake? I do mean for God's sake, you know, because right. Then the icon that you're all following, I love Mary's compassion, but not to give her a body seems to me a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
Terrible. And then terrible for women who are trying to kind of find themselves. You have to think, no, I have a body. I have a body, you know. And And it is part of
that was a very rich laugh. That spoke hours right there. Is there one of the five that you either, you've put this into five separate plays, as you mentioned earlier. Is there one that you either relate to most or had difficulty settling in on? Or?
Well, I have to say, too, the one that you saw, the sexual merges with the spiritual new knowledge, which might be the key to the whole lot.
Or the shift, the big shift.
The biggest shift in the whole lot. Is the one that it is very difficult to articulate what it means, the sexual merging with the spiritual, and why is that such a breakthrough? So that we're still working in the midst of that. I have to say I love part three because that's about women disguising themselves as men or as nuns or something like that so that they can have their voices. And I feel as if I disguised myself for a long time and tried to be things that I didn't always say what I thought, you know, which I by and large do now.
I don't know you, but I know that about you.
So that's called going underground or dying to tell the truth, because all the women in the third part are struggling to tell the truth all the time about what's going on. And if they stay in their frocks, they get killed for it. And if they disguise themselves, they're able to have their voices. They organize everybody and all ends up terribly well. I have to say I like playing the fourth part best, which is Chaos Is Come Again, which is when the women start taking on the men's voices and start wanting, you know, the same kind of goals as men. They're ambitious. They want power. They want to make sure everybody does things their way, you know. And that's a very crass vision of masculine, but, you know, that kind of masculine thrust, if I can say. So it's the eldest daughters and Lear and Lady Macbeth and Coriolanus, the mother. And I don't do the mother. Nige actually does the mother. I do Coriolanus. We do a gender switch in that. But I love playing that one, and I'm not sure. I might say something terrible about me, actually.
Well, no one will know. Feel free. Come on.
And then, of course, the last one, which is about the maiden phoenix, the daughter redeems the father, it has got all the love in it. So that's beautiful to play, and it's very moving, and it's fun. So it's the late plays. But, of course, the thing is, we know the first part the best, the warrior women from violence to negotiation. You know, so we rock and roll in that probably more than any other. You know, we've built that one. That's the most firmly established of all of them. So they all have things that I love and that's, we're still struggling with. And Eric Tucker, our director, of course, is really trying to direct it like it's just a found performance. You know, we've just got bits and pieces of rehearsal machinery round and about and things like that.
Right. Mm. Well, in seeing it the other night, the third one, you're talking about the sexuality into spirituality.
Yeah.
I came away not knowing, which was fine, how much was actually improv'd.
I'm not telling you. No, I will. No, I will. I will, Robin. The narrative begins with me talking about what is important to me. Then what's happened over the time we've been doing it is Nige challenges me on certain things.
Yes,
or says,
that's what I wonder.
Yeah.
Yes.
And sometimes, so we have now some places that look totally spontaneous that actually aren't anymore spontaneous. Mm. They began spontaneous, but now we just recreate what we did. But there were two times he challenged me the other night when you were there, which were totally spontaneous, and I could have thumped him one of the times.
I think I know which time that was. You're not that good an actress. No, actually, you are. I couldn't help but feel when you all opened up the other night, I just was, and I'm not just saying this, it was an awe-inspiring moment because the characters came out, it came alive, and I knew I was in the presence of very seasoned players.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Robin.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was quite amazing. Yeah. What do you think you went through? What's something that stands out for you? And obviously you've been studying Shakespeare's exploration of art and the psyche through the female character. What would you say is something that really stood out for you that you said, oh my gosh?
Well, I think the moment when I started getting the sexual merges with the spiritual, that actually, because I hadn't got that as a whole section. And then, of course, what happens is that you start having to look at your own life. And that's quite something when the plays actually start you forcing to look at your own life. And, you know, it really led me to question so many things about my own life, about how I'd spent my time, how I was spending my time. You know, you have to, if you do this material, it's volatile. And because you're doing it, you're not, I know I am talking, but it's in my body, you know, I'm acting it. It knocks you about. Yeah. You know, it knocks you about.
And I could feel that, you know, and I could see that in the performance the other night.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that I've really had to come to terms with is my own violence. You know, part four is about the violence in women and the fact that I can't just say, oh, I'm just a sweet, loving, I'm not. I have a streak of violence in me. It's rarely exposed. You know, I rarely plummet. And I'm not a man, so I'm not asked to plummet in the way. I'm not asked to go and fight wars like men are. I'm not asked to defend, you know, in the way men are or be aggressive on the football field the way men are.
Right, but there is that mother bear,
whether
there are children or not.
Absolutely, and it is there. And but it doesn't only come out at those times. I think it can come out at times when you feel your whole being is being destroyed or something like that, you know. And I think, you know, so I had to come to terms with that as well, because I do it on stage, so that triggers it in me.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of like being a therapist. You have to constantly work on yourself
It's
not going to live. It's not going to go anywhere. We're so short on time, but I do want to ask you a quick question. You are directing Nigel, who is in the five-part plays with you, as Richard in Richard the Third. What is it about the Richard the Third that is yours alone?
There's nothing about it that is mine alone. It's kind of the thing that I feel as if I was able to get some real leverage on is the voices of the women, obviously, in the play, and especially the mother and how she deals with Richard at the end. So I feel as if I was able to support that to come into action. It's an extraordinary moment when the mother confronts Richard at the end. I feel for Nigel's performance that actually what you're seeing is something that's always been there inside him, but it's really coming out now. We always use parts of ourselves when we're acting, but I feel as if Nigel's releasing his kind of six-year-old that pulls the wings off butterflies for various things. And I do think Nigel's gone deeply into the deformity, the effect the deformity has had him. So we actually show the deformity at one point, the hunchback. I think that comes from the deepest part of Nigel. And I think I have to say, even though I directed it, he did most of that. And it's an extraordinary piece of work.
Many thanks to Tina Packer. Her presence on stage is extraordinary. So treat yourself. See her performance in Women of Will and her directorship of Richard III, or any of the other performances at this year's Colorado Shakespeare Festival. For information, it's coloradoshakes.org. And for any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.